session number 3036601.
This is an attempt to formulate something for family history relating to the life and experiences of myself, Robert Arthur Denmark, formerly a Far East prisoner of war in Japan. I have been pursued constantly by my sister Vera, and now by her delightful son Philip, to attempt this effort. Without Philip's help and knowledge of information technology, I would have been helpless. So here goes. I was born on the 2nd of April 1922, the second son of Walter George Denmark and Florence Maud Denmark, one of five children, the late Edward Flight Sergeant RAF, Vera Kathleen, Walter and Gertrude Lillian. We were well cared for children of devoted parents, a difficult time for them in the hard times of 1920 and 30s. We enjoyed the usual childhood pursuits, encompassing happy times and disappointments, but we all survived until reaching adulthood. I became very sport orientated, mainly soccer and cricket, and after playing for several years, I was cajoled into becoming the founder honorary secretary of Norman Old Boys Football Club by the late Charles Thorne and Alfred Luthwaite, teachers in the senior boys' school in which I entered through the phases of infant and primary sections. Our club had considerable success in this modest form of amateur soccer in the Norwich and District League and premier sections of the same league. Unfortunately, war was declared on the 3rd of September 1939, which curtailed the football program somewhat. My brother Edward, Ted, now deceased, was the first of our family to answer the call of the nation and joined the RAF in 1940, later to make the supreme sacrifice for his country as Flight Sergeant EWG Denmark Wireless Operator Air Gunner. More about this later. I was the next to enter the armed forces, joining the Royal Navy in September 1941. I was enrolled for training to become a DEMS rating, a branch of the Royal Navy which was the sole purpose of the defence only of defensively equipped merchant ships of the British Mercantile Marine. I was to report to HMS Glendower in Pwllheli, North Wales, a shore establishment built to be, but unused as, a Butlin's holiday camp. Training consisted of several weeks of seamanship, field training and musketry, and boat pulling in a 32-foot cutter in Cardigan Bay. Ceremonial guards took us to Llandudno, Conway, Rhyl and Colwyn Bay. Then the relief of a return home on a long weekend pass. On return to Glendower, we started on an intense course of all aspects of becoming proficient gunnery ratings and to become able seamen with QR3 rating. Myself and most of the others in our class attained this distinction by early 1942, with a princely increase of 3D per day extra, 3 shillings and 3 pence per day to be precise. Next, I was dispatched to the Royal Hotel Glasgow to await a placement on any ship awaiting a gunnery rating. After a short stay, I was transferred to the Bay of Oban on the west coast of Scotland. This was an assembly base to establish a number of ships to leave the UK in the form of convoys. A period of weeks was spent on servicing various ships in the bay with supplies and armaments, etc. Then came my placement as a DMS rating, and I joined the SS Kirkpool, a 4,842 gross ton ship owned by the Poole Shipping Company, managers Sir Robert Rookner Limited. I joined forces with three other naval ratings, J. Dixon Gunlayer, Tom Owen QR3, James Armstrong QR3, and two Army gunners, C. Bryden and W. Hampton. The ship's defensive armament consisted of one 4-inch BL gun on poop deck and three depth charges with smaller arms on port and starboard sides amidships. The gunner's quarters were under the poop deck leading into the after well deck, and we were isolated from the ship's officers and seamen who were non-combatant and carrying out their peacetime occupations. The accommodation was comfortable, but being my first deep sea voyage, I could not make comparisons. My service shipmates were very friendly, and soon Tubby Dixon, our gunlayer, took advantage of my sewing expertise, and I was soon carrying out uniform repairs and sewing on his many non-substantive badges, including one for good conduct. Dixon was a plasterer in civil life. J. Armstrong, C. Bryden and W. Hampton were Scots, to my greatest recollection. Tom Owen became my closest friend, and we exchanged food on certain days to suit his religious beliefs, e.g. eggs for bacon, etc. The food on board was very good. Rationing in the UK seemed non-existent, and deservedly so, as the Merchant Navy were bringing food into the country at such very great risk. While still at anchor, shore leave was allowed between watchkeeping. Eventually, we were ready to leave port, and the formation of a convoy was established. Convoy was the method of several merchant ships in a fairly compact formation with faster and better armoured Royal Naval vessels defending the perimeters from U-boats and German surface raiders. Destroyers and corvettes were the type of vessels used, assisted also by Fleet Air Arm, Sunderlands and Catalinas, while we were still close to the British mainland. Watchkeeping was intensified into two watches of 4 hours on and 4 hours watch below. I found this very tiring, coupled by the fact that I had become violently seasick. This lasted almost a week, during which time I lost my appetite, but on recovery I found a donkey's. We steamed on for days on end without incident. The Navy escorts were doing their job to deter any danger. Finally, it was time for the escorts to leave their defensive duties and let the cargo ships proceed to their various destinations on their own. This breaking from convoy took place about 3 degrees north of the equator, 0 degrees. The customary initial ceremonies were performed on those who were crossing the line for the first time. Bosun Larsen acted as King Neptune, and all of us in turn were subjected to various forfeits and some totally humiliating tasks. The Kirkpool's destination was Lourenco Marques in Mozambique to collect a cargo of iron ore and return it to the UK. Our route, now we were travelling alone, was down the west coast of Africa to Cape Town. then around the Cape into the Mozambique Straits and Lourenco Marques. Some days before reaching Cape Town, we had the excitement of the forward seamen spotting a U-boat's periscope, then surfacing to then crash dive again. As the Kirkpull carried 3 depth charges, it was hoped that we could make a kill, but the echo-sounding device showed nothing, so no action was taken. We eventually arrived in Cape Town without further incident. Then we witnessed the glorious delight of seeing Table Mountain in all its splendour and free from its top cover of cloud. After the long cold journey from Oban, the North Atlantic, and recollections of my own local knowledge of the North Sea, the delights of the South African climate and sunshine were heaven sent. Our stay in Cape Town was very brief, with no shore leave, ships' orders having been altered from the original destination. Our new orders were to proceed to Durban, further along the coast of South Africa, then to take on board a cargo of black diamonds, mercantile slang for coal. Our new destination was Montevideo in Uruguay. The loading of the new cargo was undertaken on the Bluff in Durban, and consequently the gunners had plenty of shore leave, as loading was mechanical and supervised by the Merchant Navy. A lot of the heavy labouring jobs were performed by convicts from a nearby penal colony on the Bluff, in their striped jersey suits and chain manacles. They were a sorry sight and extremely hungry. The compassionate nature of the British welled within us, and we threw vast amounts of food to them. This was to prove very ironic, as will become clear later. Cargo loading and ship's supplies completed, we were now ready to move, and we left Durban on the 31st of March 1942, bound for Montevideo. The next few days spent steaming with intense watchkeeping in a very vulnerable part of the South Atlantic became quite monotonous. Staring at nothing but vast amounts of sea seemed to be a waste of time, apart from the importance of our task to get food to our beleaguered island. I spent the 2nd of April, my birthday, in much quieter conditions than I would have expected to celebrate 20 years. Nevertheless, thankful to be still safe and sound on such a dangerous mission. 10th of April dawned with overcast weather and quite a heavy sea running. Watches in the forenoon and afternoon were quite unpleasant, and I was thankful to become watch below with no incidents to report during the day. At approximately 20 hours, a violent lurch of the ship awakened me. A torpedo from a German surface raider had scored a direct hit. All hell was let loose, as salvo after salvo of very heavy gunfire rained on us, smashing parts of the superstructure to pieces and causing fires to start everywhere. The gunfire continued for a long time without respite, and at very short range. It seemed that the raider was intent on sinking us by surface fire, as the torpedoing was taking longer than expected to achieve its aim. Under such intense bombardment and heavily underarmed in comparison to our enemy, it was impossible to retaliate, and survival became essential. Most escape rafts were either released or smashed in the action. The starboard lifeboat was blown from the davits with several Indian firemen attempting to escape by lowering it. The whole episode seemed to shambles, but mercifully the firing stopped. After the first few weeks training in gunnery at HMS Glendower, this was proved to be a totally unequal contest against better trained and superior armed opponents. Several of us gathered in the after well deck searching for something to evacuate safely on. Captain Kennington then arrived and advised us to abandon ship as she was sinking fast. Seeing we had no escape material, he suggested a cargo net with buoyant material attached on the forecastle head was possible escape material. Several hands went with him to release it, and the remainder of us waited patiently with hope of its arrival. Heaven sent, the net duly came floating down the port side, and we all jumped in unison. Myself, a very moderate swimmer, I was very relieved to grasp the net, which proved to be a lifesaver to several of the crew. We drifted slowly away from the Kirkpool, now well alight, and providing a firework display, as small arms bullets began exploding. The illuminations kept us abreast of the happenings, with the Kirkpool still afloat. Now drifting well away from the Kirkpool, the chill of the South Atlantic began to take effect after the adrenaline of the action subsided. Most of us were scantily clad, myself only in a singlet and Kapok life jacket. Gathering thoughts of possible sharks in the area was not comforting. Possibly in the water for over an hour, time did seem not to register while clinging on to life. The weather conditions became darker, and our thoughts of survival likewise. Suddenly in the gloom we saw the raider, a dark grey silhouette making directly towards our raft, then veering away from us into darkness again. Our last hopes of rescue, we thought. The last manoeuvre of the raider was, however, a mercy mission, as quite soon a motor launch with a high-powered searchlight located us and pulled us from the cruel sea. A very young engineer's messroom boy was lashed into the launch, severely wounded and attempting to hold the remnants of his buttocks together. The raider captain at last seemed to be showing some compassion for the terrible battering he had inflicted on us. To wait in such a vulnerable area to pick up survivors for such a long time, while exposing his ship to possible extinction by any Royal Naval craft, was a credit to him. The wounded were attended straight away, and the rest of us were made comfortable. The German officers and men plied us liberally with cognac and rye bread sausage sandwiches. I remember going to bed quite tipsy. A moderate interrogation took place, mainly to get records for kith and kin notification. It took me quite some time to convince my interrogators that Denmark was my surname and not my country. Now warm again and nourished, we settled into our temporary accommodation for the remainder of the night. Next day we were aroused early and taken to our more permanent prison quarters. These were in the central position in the bowels of the ship, below the waterline. Access and egress were by a companionway with a heavy steel lockable lid. Exercise on deck was allowed 1 hour forenoon and 1 hour afternoon daily. We were quite surprised to find the survivors of three other freighters already incarcerated, namely the Wellpark, Willesden and the Norwegian ship Oost. The accommodation was well established with air conditioning and pumped toilet waste. The next hours were abuzz with crews exchanging questions and answers about their various experiences. The first exercise on deck seemed so short but gloriously welcome. We were now more able to assess the considerable armament of the raider, so heavily camouflaged as cargo crates. Also partially concealed was a small seaplane, cheekily marked in bold letter U.S. Navy. Later post-war data named the raider as the Thor, with armament of 6 5.9-inch guns, smaller 37mm down to 20mm, and 4 22-inch torpedo tubes. The range of 1,700 yards sinking the Kirkpool was virtually point-blank. Internet and email by the Deutsche Kriegsmarine supplied this information. About 3 days later, the afternoon exercise was stopped. The steel cover over our access steps was shut, with a further steel strap added. The air conditioning was turned off, leaving us to wonder why. Then the extra throbbing of the ship's engines showed we were increasing speed to pursue or being pursued by a possible victim or an encounter by the Royal Navy. The loss of air and the fear of being sunk again by further action whilst being securely imprisoned below the waterline was becoming insufferable. After 2 to 3 hours, the engines quietened, air was restored, and the prison officer came down and stated that the prey they were pursuing was too fast for them. The days that followed were very repetitive, being roused early and the daily visit by the prison officers to inquire if we had any complaints, which were dealt with whenever possible. Towards the end of our 24 days on the Thor, we were moving into very cold and unpleasant conditions, which seemed to indicate we were getting well into the southern Antarctic Ocean. A change of course northerly convinced the navigators we were heading for the southern half of the Indian Ocean. The assumption proved to be correct, and a rendezvous with the German motor ship Regensburg was made. The object of the exercise was to transfer all the prisoners from the Thor to the Regensburg. This was duly accomplished, and we joined some 200 to 300 prisoners already aboard. Accommodation was in the tween decks, in hammocks, 4 to each stanchion into welded floor sockets. Hammocks and stanchions removed daily to allow more room. The whole of the forecastle was for the prisoners, including self-contained heads and showers. The lower bridge was heavily armed with machine guns manned by German officers, not ratings. Special security to prevent a possible revolt by the prisoners. White lines were painted several metres before the bridge gate to the galley, was explained to us, so infringement was only accepted whilst food was collected at delegated times by certain orderlies. The Thor left to seek further prey, and we remained fairly stationary for days and making very uncomplimentary remarks about who ruled the waves. The Thor had further success catching the SS Nankin, a passenger cargo vessel taking bank employees back to India, and with a prize crew on board, met up with the Regensburg to transfer further prisoners with us. The Regensburg and the Nankin now lay side by side at sensible distances, and a motor launch and large rubber inflatable rafts proceeded to remove all valuable cargo from the Nanking. Large stocks of frozen lamb and a deck cargo of wool were brought to the Regensburg. This went on for days on end. Soon afterwards, the Nanking, with prize crew aboard, left us. A sudden spell of fast steaming found us meeting up with the German ship, the Dresden, and all wounded personnel and women and children from the Nanking and some merchant seamen were transferred to the Dresden. This achieved, she left in an easterly direction, which pointed to an obvious destination, Japan. On the Regensburg, we continued to idle in the Indian Ocean, possibly to still act in the capacity of supplying the Thor if necessary. The next few days were spent in idyllic conditions, just lounging on deck in glorious weather, with plenty of food and sleep and no work. Certainly a life of Riley, but we were always aware that we could be attacked by our own forces. By now, with no idea of day or date, we also started to move in an easterly direction, ominous to a possible visit to Japan, and with some trepidation at the thought of going to a nation with completely different cultures. Our worst fears were confirmed when we made calls at Borneo, Java, Sumatra, and we eventually arrived in Yokohama. To our surprise, we were then shepherded onto another German vessel moored in the bay, namely the motor ship Ramses, to now be kept under German safeguard. To be kept by the same friendly individuals that we had encountered on both the Thor and the Regensburg was quite pleasing. But all good things come to an end, and on the disastrous day of the 25th of August 1942, we were officially handed over to the Japanese. Transported by open lorries, about 170 of us were taken to No. 1 Camp Kawasaki, Tokyo, Nippon. This included Captain Kennington, First Engineer Burley, and several Indian firemen from the Kirkpool. The language barrier was soon to become an obstacle, as few Japanese guards spoke English. The first friction occurred when trying to convince the Japanese officers we would not survive without a European diet. We were just ridiculed, and mountains of rice and gnat's water soup were dumped, but when hunger beckoned, we had to eat to survive. This initiation to supposed Japanese culture was very disturbing. We soon learned that even failing to salute the lowest ranks upwards of the military incited a frenzied beating. This method of punishment was also meted out to even their own citizens. It was called binta. The two-story wooden structure we were housed in proved to be an unsanitary and bug-infested dwelling with cold water only, external washing facilities and external primitive toilets. The toilets were narrow wooden huts with earthenware pots sunk into the ground, with a 12-inch by 5-inch hole cut in the floor. Within days of use, the pots became a seething mass of maggots. Consequently, the inevitable happened. Vast amounts of sickness and dysentery. I soon succumbed to the latter, and survival without medication was totally reliant on one's previous constitution. This form of disease left me with an amoebic condition which I was to remain with for the next 3.5 years,